All right. Now it's gone. Yeah, and Todd Pierce is going to be here. He's a former JAG defense lawyer from Guantanamo Bay, actually. And I think he started learning the true nature of the state while he held that job. He's been getting better and better on lots of things, and he's got a thing. We're all Cheneyites now over at Consortium News. And, you know, it's about the program of World Empire. Murder-suicide on a grand scale. The project of American benevolent hegemony. You know it's okay because Bill Kristol named it benevolent. Oh, I guess there's nothing to worry about then. Good. Anyway, it's Todd Pierce. He's going to be on. It's old news for those of you who are, you know, longtime connoisseurs of this crap. But, you know, for you newbies who are trying to figure out how come America is so corrupt and evil and how come our government does nothing but murder people all day, every day, for no reason, there's a reason. Todd Pierce is going to be on to explain to you. Okay, good. And, you know, the average person, apparently, sees it more and more my way. In fact, you know, grab them at random off the street, and according to the latest Pew Research poll, I guess they'd be mystified why it is that our government seems to think it's in our national interest to kill people all day, every day, seemingly without reason. The American people aren't buying it anymore. In fact, I even read an article the other day about how even Hitler doesn't work anymore. Go, oh, Hitler! Look, everybody! Hitler! And everybody goes, yawn, Hitler. That's what she said about Manuel Noriega. That's what she said about everybody. Big deal. Remember Bill Hicks? It's like, look, everybody's a Hitler. And look, a fetus. Everybody a fetus. Whatever you, the apathetic, docile masses need to get on board for this. Oh, look, a little fetus. Hitler. He's a Hitler. And so anyway, they tried Hitler on the last few devils, and it just ain't working. People think, who, Putin? Nah, he's not so much a Hitler, not really. Bashar al-Assad? He's like a half a Saddam. And Saddam's, what, like a 75th of a Hitler or something? Not even. 1/100th of a Hitler. Assad is like the remainder. Assad is nothing. His Ba'athist tyranny is nothing compared to the German Nazis. Take your boring, tiled, old metaphor and shove it. We don't want to go to war no more. And of course, you know, if America was under attack from an enemy, then they could just say that, right? The only reason they ever got to, like, try to build up a Hitler is to justify starting a war. Because, of course, the lesson of World War II is that we should have started it before Hitler started it. And even though that would have made us, like him, a war starter, it would have been okay because it was against him. See, that's the lesson of World War II. America should have launched it in 1933. Anyway, it's not working here. New data from the Pew Research. I thought they only did this in the summertime. New data from Pew Research shows a record number of Americans are adverse to military interventionism internationally, with a strong majority believing the U.S. should, quote, mind its own business. And I hope they don't think that means the national government ought to mind all of our business. But still, it's better than, you know, just slaughtering foreigners all day long just to get rid of the bombs and replace them in the inventory, you know? Analysts are trying to spin this as, quote, disillusionment with the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. And indeed, another polling figure reveals most believe the past decade of war has left the U.S., quote, less important and powerful. And less safe, too. Remember, that was your big excuse? Remember, that was the poll question after the invasion of Iraq. The American people say they feel safer because of the invasion of Iraq. Are they safer? Or they, it doesn't matter, it's only a question of whether they feel better now. Anyway, they seem to be okay with the idea of being less powerful, as most believe the U.S. tries to do too much intervening abroad and pushes for a shared leadership role. And anyway, so now, last summer when the Pew International Trust did their study, they didn't just come out and say, oh, look, the American people are anti-war now. They admitted. Pew, which might as well be the Council on Foreign Relations, which might as well be the establishment. They admitted last summer that this is not isolationism. You know, they would deny that that's even a smear at all. But they would admit that this is not isolationism, whatever you call it. Even if there is a plain old definition, there's no such real people in American politics who are really isolationists. Even left-wing labor unions and right-wing paleocons want some foreign trade, want some openness with the world. There's no isolationists in America anywhere. They don't even consider that a smear, though. They would, you know, mostly consider probably left-wing labor union protectionists and right-wing paleocon protectionists as isolationists. But they have to admit that that's not the majority opinion here. The majority opinion is anti-war, but is for open trade, free trade, and open associations with all other peoples of the world. Peoples, a stupid word. They're anti-war, but they are not against international relationships, just violent ones. And even the Pew International Trust has to admit that now, which I think is great and kind of hilarious, because these are the guys who always try to say that any opposition to starting wars is cowardly pro-Hitler isolationism. Like that one time when some people didn't want to start a war. It was terrible. And anyway, I'm surprised that the orders have not come down to Pew to stop doing these polls for a while until we can gin up some fake excuse. Something better than he's a Hitler and point our finger. Otherwise, you're going to keep reinforcing what the American people think here. Hey, that's right. We do think that. Hey, that's right. That is the supermajority opinion in America. That we want peace. That we're tired of the big, fake, giant, blowbackian war on terror. Tired of all of it. Even the American people even are against the war in Afghanistan, and they're against the war in Afghanistan in higher percentages than they were ever even opposed to Vietnam or any other war in American history. And that's the one that at least started out under the excuse as revenge for 9/11. That's how, disillusioned the American people are with any of this militarism at this point. And unfortunately, they're not angry enough about it. Well, supposedly, seemingly, they're not quite angry enough. Although, you made your voices pretty loudly heard last summer when it came to Syria. And it seems like there's pretty good support for a nuclear deal with Iran right now, which that's pretty good. Oh, and by the way, here's one more thing from the Pew Research surveys, is that the American people more and more are over the drug war. And the way they put it here, this is America.AlJazeera.com. They're really over it. And not just the war on pot, but the war on all hard drugs, too. Could it be they're finally learning about the economics of prohibition and black markets and how they don't work and cause crime? Because no one is going to openly support cocaine and heroin use, really, right? Not among the mainstream. But they could, be made aware of the economic arguments against prohibition and could get better along those lines.
Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson is a successful former hedge fund manager who provides his subscribers with a very real window into his investments, updating them on every move he makes in the markets. Right now, Mike's anticipating a bear and is dumping all the stocks while the getting is good, investing instead in gold and the commodities. Protect your assets and learn the wise ways of the markets. WallStreetWindow.com. And check out Mike Swanson's great contribution to the history of the rise of the American Empire and the war state, available at scotthorton.org/Amazon. Hey, y'all, Scott here. First, I want to take a second to thank all the show's listeners, sponsors, and supporters for helping make this show what it is. I literally couldn't do it without you. And now I want to tell you about the newest way to help support the show. Whenever you shop at Amazon.com, stop by ScottHorton.org first and just click the Amazon logo on the right side of the page. That way, the show will get a kickback from Amazon's end of the sale. It won't cost you an extra cent. And it's not just books. Amazon.com sells just about everything in the world, except cars, I think. So whatever you need, they've got it. Just click the Amazon logo on the right side of the page at ScottHorton.org or go to ScottHorton.org/Amazon.
All right, y'all. Welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This here is my show. Let's talk about this Fort Hood shooting. So, if you ain't heard, some guy killed three people, wounded a bunch of others, and then shot himself in the head. That's what they say. Plausible enough, anyway. And the good news is it wasn't a Muslim. So, I guess he could have been a convert. No indications so far as I know yet, anyway, that, this guy was a Muslim or this was political at all. The headlines I saw, anyway. The chatter, which is just as good as actual information if you ask the government, is that this was just a personal beef. It started, at least, as a personal beef between two soldiers, and then the one of them brought a gun and killed the other one, and then some other people around, too, and I don't know exactly the whole everything. But it, at least, you know, apparently was not about the occupation of Palestine or Afghanistan or the Arabian Peninsula or anything like that. So that's good, because, you know, if it was, they would try to say, yeah, it's Islam made them do it. So now we have to go after all the people who believe in Islam. And somebody actually sent me a tweet that was based on, it wasn't his opinion, but he was showing me somebody else's tweet, kind of a thing, a link to a tweet, where a guy was, first of all, I believe, assuming that, of course, this is a Muslim shooter at Fort Hood. And if this happens one more time, we ought to start just killing Muslims in the streets, he said. Now, this is just some kook. It's not like he was a major, you know, Republican leader or anything like this. But the thing about it is, well, there's so many things about it. One thing about it is that any idiot or anyone smarter than that, without prompting, ought to be able to consider the fact that there are millions of American Muslims right now. There are millions of Muslims in America right now, American ones and foreigners too. And none of them are at war with the United States. If this guy was some Sunni radical, you know, getting revenge for the killing of Osama or some crap, then he would still just be one out of millions. And that action would still only prove that the rest of the Muslims in America are just people in America, just like everybody else. But I don't know why it is that's so hard for people to come up with themselves. Huh, I guess you're right. I guess there are millions of Muslims right now who aren't shooting anyone, who aren't blowing anything up, who aren't setting anything on fire, who aren't melting down the mortgage market or spending all our money on a bunch of no good, do nothing nuclear missiles. They're just trying to put food on their family just like everybody else. They're just regular people just like everybody else. You idiots who believe politicians. You believe politicians? When they tell you that the reason that people are motivated to commit terrorist attacks against the United States of America is because of their religion and not anything that those politicians have done to them, what are you, stupid? Conservatives. They'll believe anything as long as it's not true. Anything. Okay, and now here's how stupid liberals are. I turn on MSNBC today, and the first thing out of their mouths, it's not just that they're sure they're right. They're so sure they're right, they're mocking any right-winger or libertarian who would say that it makes no sense for Fort Hood, the biggest military base in America, to be a gun-free zone. Where people are supposed to shelter in place, like elementary school students, if there's a shooting. When they're the freaking army. They're the army. Now you're telling the rest of all society that we should accept all of these men being trained to be expert killers. Quartered among us. Standing in perpetuity. But that we can't trust them with firearms? Is that what you're saying? The only ones of them that we can trust with firearms are the military policemen. But not the enlisted men? What about their officers? Am I living in some ridiculous sitcom or something here? What the hell are you talking about? Fort Hood is a gun-free zone? How could that possibly be true? Because Democrats made it that way. Oh, Democrats and Republicans. But when I turned to MSNBC this morning, they had a quote from Fox News of a guy saying, man, the guy's got a gun. He's breaking the law, you know, with his gun. While he's also breaking the law, murdering people. But the people he's murdering, why, they're all law-abiding soldiers who are not carrying firearms. Three of whom had to just lay down and die. So they play a clip from Fox News of someone saying, damn, man, it's too bad that these other soldiers, who after all are soldiers, y'all. So even if you're for gun control, then you think only soldiers and cops should have guns, right? Well, these guys are soldiers. So the Fox News guys are saying, look, these guys are fucking soldiers. For them to be disarmed and to be sitting ducks in front of this criminal who would murder them is kind of insane, isn't it? And MSNBC plays this clip, and they all just laugh at it. I think it's Joy Reid and her guests. They laugh at this like it's just self-refuting. And when they finally get their composure back, the guy says, look, if the other people had been armed, then there would have been more bullets flying around. Oh, you know what? That was what it was. See, I'm telling the story wrong. They weren't on Fox News. The clip was from earlier on MSNBC on the Chuck Todd show. And it was Chuck Todd on MSNBC who said to the Republicans, yeah, but then more bullets would be flying. And they're saying, yeah, but some from the innocent victims toward the guy who's trying to kill them. So, you see how, you know, it's not exactly the same thing, Chuck. And then that was where they stopped the clip, and that was where they're just laughing. And this whole thing is supposed to be self-refuting. Everybody knows only murderers and police should have guns, and everyone else should just lay down and die. It's better than risking someone missing while trying to defend themselves from someone who's trying to murder them. Really? This is what liberals think with their brains. Ask a liberal. And that's what they'll tell you. Yes, victims should lay down and die. The only people who should have guns are murderers and cops. And especially murderer cops. Them more than anyone else. And if they murder anyone, then 2 weeks paid vacation, but then, you know, back to work killing people some more. But a victim, even if they're a soldier, even if they're a government employee, they still should be disarmed. All military bases should be gun-free zones. should be gun-controlled, according to the liberals. I don't know what to tell you guys. This is the world that we live in. These are the people who run things. People who are wrong about everything that they think because of how stupid they are. These are the prevailing opinions. This is consensus. And guess what? Go up the road to Dallas and somebody gets shot to death every day. Go to Houston. Somebody's getting shot every day. Come to Austin. Somebody's getting shot by a cop every day. People get shot to death in Texas every day. Husbands shoot their wives. Drug dealers shoot each other. Cops shoot whoever they feel like. People murder each other all the freaking time. There are 12,000 just gun murders a year. That doesn't include all the baseball bats and the knives and the, the wire across the roadway. Whatever other ingenious methods, axes and wood chippers and however else poison, however else people murder each other. The electric chair, the needle, sending somebody off to fight in a war that you lied them into, whatever it is. For some reason, this is supposed to be the biggest deal in the world. And for some reason, you're not supposed to notice that whenever you see these multiple victims in these so-called, they're usually multiple victims. I don't know. How many people does it take to break into the news cycle as a mass shooting for, Pierce Morgan purposes or whatever? And then they say the same thing every time. It couldn't possibly be their fault for creating all these gun-free zones. This is just proof that we need even more gun control, because at some point, this magic gun control that they believe in, this mythology, this religion of theirs, insists that murderers like Lopez here, just they won't be able to find a gun anywhere, I guess. I guess. Is that what you think, liberals? If there's enough gun control, then murderers will not be able to even find a gun to break the murder laws and the gun control laws with? Is that what you really think? Do you think at all? Other than, boy, I better memorize my talking points of things that liberals think. I saw one the other day from Michael Moore, the big fat millionaire hypocrite communist, complaining about the mudslide up there in Washington State and blaming capitalism. Oh, capitalism kills, said his hashtag. And then you follow the link, and guess who owned the hillside? The government, who leased it out for corporations to come and clear cut and leave again. That sounds like the tragedy of communist commons to me, Michael Moore, you big, fat, capitalist, hypocrite, scumbag. But oh well, just blame it on freedom. That's your talking point. Memorize it. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State. In The War State, Swanson examines how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy both expanded and fought to limit the rise of the new national security state after World War II. If this nation is ever to live up to its creed of liberty and prosperity for everyone, we are going to have to abolish the empire. Know your enemy. Get The War State by Michael Swanson. It's available at your local bookstore or at Amazon.com in Kindle or in paperback. Just click the book in the right margin at ScottHorton.org or TheWarState.com. Hey y'all, Scott Horton here for CashIntoCoins.com. So you want to buy some Bitcoins? CashIntoCoins.com makes it fast, easy, and safe to get Bitcoins. Just deposit the money into their account at any of the major banks they support, and then just email them a picture of the receipt and your Bitcoin address, and you get your Bitcoins. Almost always the same day it clears. In a tough, competitive new market, CashIntoCoins.com has the advantage. A great system and great customer service to keep you coming back. That's CashIntoCoins.com. Just click the link in the right margin at ScottHorton.org. All right, y'all, welcome back. Now, I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, Scott Horton Show. All right, so Barrett Brown now. Barrett Brown signs plea agreement. After a year and a half in jail awaiting trial, the writer-journalist Barrett Brown, best known for his previous association with Anonymous, through his defense team, has reportedly reached an agreement with the government to plea to some counts. Full details are not available since the documents are sealed. And reportedly is a hot link here to Wired.com. I'm reading at Free Barrett Brown, tumblr.freebarrettbrown.org. This marks a big step towards resolution of a tangled and complex case implicating the First Amendment in numerous ways, which originally began when the FBI executed search warrants at Barrett Brown and his mother's home in March of 2012. Since he was arrested, Brown has maintained his innocence and originally pleaded not guilty to all counts against him. The director of his legal defense fund, Kevin Gallagher, said, "The Barrett Brown who I know and call my friend has never been one to compromise with the government. But in this instance, I think he recognized that taking this case before a jury in conservative Texas is a massive roll of the dice. In fact, I think this whole thing would have been settled." What, like conservatives love government more than liberals do? Give me a break. They're all a bunch of reds, if you ask me. "In fact, I think this whole thing would have been settled long ago if not for the fact that the government had filed excessive..." That's not really fair. They're all a bunch of brown shirts, if you ask me. That's better, really. Okay. "The whole thing could have been settled long ago if not for the fact that the government had filed excessive and meritless charges, which they later dropped. I'm pleased that the parties..." Who's I? Oh, it's Kevin Gallagher, the director of his legal defense fund, I'm reading here. "I'm pleased that the parties were able to reach this agreement, although in principle he shouldn't have to plead to anything. This spares everyone the spectacle of a costly trial, and the bottom line is that Barrett will be coming home, as he's already served 19 months unnecessarily. In motions filed with the court, Brown's defense had made a strong case for dismissal, which combined with negative publicity surrounding the prosecution of a nonviolent writer-journalist who caused no actual harm, perhaps influenced the government to seek to settle. Wired is reporting that the maximum statutory sentence he could face between both of his cases would likely be 5 years." So I think that means even with the plea deal. And of course, what's happened to Barrett here is completely ridiculous and ought to be illegal. Although there's no law that applies to the government, even how they're to apply the law to us. They can just do whatever the hell they want. That's the thing about it. It ain't anarchy. That would be a lack of law. But it's lawlessness, which I think just means there's no consistency in it at all, other than people with power get to do whatever they want, and they get to do whatever they want to people with no power. So if they want to charge Barrett Brown with 750 things and then make him plead guilty to two of them, then I guess that's what he'll have to do. Make him agree to 5 years in prison for not doing anything wrong at all. For not really committing a crime at all. Make him agree to 5 years. Because otherwise he's facing decades. And for what? For posting a link to a webpage in a chat room? For threatening to Google and research the life of an FBI agent and post the results of those Google searches online? It just goes to show you, when the charges against him are so completely ridiculous, it just goes to show you how completely out of control the power of this government is. That here, Barrett Brown has some of the best lawyers, right? The lawyers that won the Hamdan case against Donald Rumsfeld in the Supreme Court. I mean, these guys are heroic badasses among lawyers. And they apparently told Barrett, "You better sign this thing, dude." I don't know what to say about it. I guess what comes to mind really is about the outrage. Now I can't even think of what they call it. Fatigue. That's what it is. Outrage, fatigue. Yeah, they tortured this guy. Yeah, they lied about this reason for war. Yeah, they're lying about that reason for war. Yeah, they did a coup in Ukraine and they're lying about that. And yeah, and all they do is lie and torture and murder people all the time. And all they do is frame up people on terrorism charges all the time. And all they do is lie about everything all the time. They're saving the location of everywhere all of our cell phones ever were. I mean, what? And people, you just tune it out, man. Tune back into sports. Did you hear they got another season of your favorite sport coming up? Or whatever. And I don't mean to make fun of what you love. I mean, I love skateboarding. That's sort of a sport in a way. That's my thing. I'm glad everybody loves their thing. But that's what they're trying to get us to do, is to just give up. Or at least that's the effect of it. I don't know, trying to tire me. That's the effect of it, is to just make people shrug. Because you got to figure, if it was a normal country in a normal time, if this was the America they, you know, raise us up to believe exists and all of that crap, what's happening to Barrett Brown right now would be absolutely outrageous. It would be the biggest thing in the whole world. It would dominate every news cycle. Missing plane or no missing plane. But instead, there's so much going on that, well, come on, I mean, this is just one journalist that they're putting in prison for no reason. How does that stack up? How does that even get on your list ahead of Russia and Palestine and Afghanistan and torture today, Scott Horton? Come on. When we've got Russia and Palestine and Afghanistan and torture still to cover. I don't know. Truth is, I think it's important. I'd like for it to be important to other people. Thing is, I know it's important to other people. When I'm complaining about this outrage fatigue, I'm really just talking about me, right? This Barrett Brown thing is important to me, but how important? You know, can I cover it? How much can I cover it? How much should I cover it? How does it compare in newsworthiness to other reporters being persecuted? Reporter sources being persecuted, NSA scandals, CIA scandals, wars in Afghanistan, Pakistan, Yemen, Somalia, Libya, Syria, and the threat of war in Eastern Europe. Although, it's a small threat, but it's a small threat of a big conflict, so it's important in its way. I don't know how to rank it, you know? There's still guys sitting at Guantanamo, never even been charged with a crime. Prison for life. No possibility of parole, never even got a hearing. Never even got a, you know, Your Honor, they got the wrong guy. You're looking for my cousin or whatever, right? Some of them haven't even gotten their writ of habeas corpus. And, you know, they were doing the writ of habeas corpus hearings there for a little while. And then there was a ruling in the federal courts that basically took the teeth out of the process of how it was to be done. So after the Hamdan decision said, no, every one of these prisoners at Gitmo, they get at least one shot in front of a federal judge to plead their case. They basically, the lower court, but the federal appeals court, has, for intents and purposes, nullified that and put an end to that process. And of course, even when or at least slowed it down so much, it doesn't hardly exist anymore. But even when they were getting their writs of habeas corpus, the judges were issuing rulings saying, let this guy go, man. You've got nothing on him. And then the executive branch is still saying, no, because he's a Uyghur, or no, because he's a Yemeni, or no, because I don't feel like it. Anyway, that's kind of a tangent, but sort of related. It's outrage fatigue. The real point being that Barrett Brown ought to be the biggest deal in the whole wide world, man, what they're doing to him. The guy's just a journalist. He didn't commit a crime. He didn't do anything to anybody. That's it. They're just persecuting him. And, you know, I sure can't blame him for pleading guilty. You know, like he's supposed to climb right up on the cross, you know, of his own volition. Forget that. I say break out and run like hell if you can, man. He should resist them with all of his might and compromise if he absolutely has to, which apparently he absolutely has to do. The Hamdan case lawyers apparently were the ones who advised him to do it. It's incredible. And here's a guy who, you know, unlike Dianne Feinstein, might say, oh, some blogger doesn't count as having free speech and freedom of the press. Well, this guy wrote for The Guardian, and he wrote for, I think, Vanity Fair and all kinds of major print publications. So screw you, lady. He's passed all your fake thresholds for who's a real journalist and who's not a real journalist. Which is completely preposterous in the first place, but still. And where in the hell are the rest of the journalists on the Bear Brown case? I mean, there are some who are good, but not many. But this isn't even a big deal inside journalism right now. Like, hey, everybody, free Bear Brown, what the hell's going on here? Who's doing a write-up on this judge? Who's doxing the federal employees carrying out this prosecution? I mean, the Washington Post and the New York Times ought to be taking the lead. But still, how many newspaper editors in America have failed to assign a reporter to unearth the story of what's really going on here? Completely out of control, this government, man, I'm telling you. And I know that the footage isn't black and white. It's all, you know, in very bright colors and high definition, Blu-ray, whatever, whatever. And they do most of their goose-stepping around in the streets in other people's countries. But that doesn't really make it any less fascism. The fact that they let us recycle our figurehead every 8 or 4 years just means it's a more sophisticated fashion than the old kind where people get sick of you and then hang you upside down and set you on fire like Mussolini, you know, kind of thing. It's a participatory fascist state, but it sure as hell is no constitutional republic. Not while Bear Brown's sitting in prison, it's not. Hey, y'all, Scott here. Ever wanted to help support the show and own silver at the same time? Well, a friend of mine, libertarian activist Arlo Pignatti, has invented the alternative currency with the most promise of them all. QR Silver Commodity Discs. The first ever QR code 1 ounce silver pieces. Just scan the back of one with your phone and get the instant spot price. They're perfect for saving or spending at the market. And anyone who donates $100 or more to the Scott Horton Show at scotthorton.org/donate gets one. That's scotthorton.org/donate. And if you'd like to learn and order more, send them a message at commoditydiscs.com or check them out on Facebook at /commoditydiscs. And thanks. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new project, Listen and Think Audio at listenandthink.com. They've got 2 new audiobooks read by the deepest voice in libertarianism, the great historian Jeff Riggenbach. Our Last Hope, Rediscovering the Lost Path to Liberty by Michael Meharry of the 10th Amendment Center is available now. And Beyond Democracy, co-authored by Frank Karsten of the Mises Institute Netherlands and journalist Carl Beckman, will be released this month. And they're only just getting started. So check out listenandthink.com. You may be able to get your first audiobook absolutely free. That's Listen and Think Audio at listenandthink.com. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. So, funny little bit of cognitive dissonance, again, with the silliness that goes on inside the brains of liberals, and conservatives, too, but I think mostly liberals got to take the rap for this one. And sorry for picking on everybody all day, but, you know, you're wrong about everything, so I got to try to set straight. So, these liberals are saying, oh my God, the Supreme Court has struck down the limits on donations. And so now... rich people are going to have the upper hand when it comes to financing elections and picking candidates. Okay, guys. Well, they'll even cite recent history. Again, it's my fault for watching a little bit MSNBC today. Yesterday it was Fox, and I just was beside myself. I couldn't believe it. And then today it's MSNBC, and it's the same damn thing. I'm like, Jesus, guys. You know? Anyway. So they're saying, well, remember the last election? Where this Sheldon Adelson guy spent all this money? Or these previous elections where these billionaires have been able to spend all this money to put their candidates in there? Well, now it's going to be like that. Huh? Wait a minute. So what's actually changed? If the billionaires already were able to give as much money as they wanted. Oh, they can only give unlimited amounts to the party, Scott, or to a super PAC, and then that super PAC can give unlimited amounts to Newt Gingrich, or whatever it is, don't you know, whatever you want to call it, on a piece of paper. But the billionaires already could give as much money as they want to bankroll whoever they want. What was the law in effect? What did it do? It restricted you. Look at the Ron Paul campaigns. In 2008 and 2012, there were, I guess, in 2012, there was one billionaire, Peter Thiel, who decided to give him some money. But other than that, no billionaires gave him any money. The Koch brothers hate Ron Paul. You know that, right? Always have, because he's a real libertarian and they're conservatives. So anyway, who supported Ron Paul? As you well know, as everybody knows, it was a bunch of nobodies. A bunch of nobodies. And I mean nobodies in the noble fashion. Us commoners. People like you and me who were only able to give $100 or $300. Or, if maybe we could swing it, $2,700. But that was the limit. And now, which of us who maybe could swing $2,700 or maybe a little more, which of us have the capability to hire a lawyer to really put together an organization that can fulfill all the loopholes that we can contribute more to it and make sure and get the money to our guy and run the ads for our guy against the guys we're against in the right places at the right times and whatever, whatever. It's very hard to do. Especially when the limit is $2,700. That means somebody who actually has a few hundred grand, right? Someone who's a millionaire but not a 100 millionaire, not a billionaire on welfare, but just an actual capitalist who might be a little bit libertarian and might be independent enough in the economy that he's willing to do something like donate to somebody like Ron Paul, completely limited from being able to do so. And so all the limits on the campaign finance stuff were all the, of course, come on. Who do you think already ran everything already? Right. The rich, evil corporations that you hate and fear so much and the people who own the stock and yeah, those guys. So, of course, all the campaign finance laws were there to keep the rest of us out. Now, how exactly it's going to work now or, you know, what to do with the new situation, I'm not sure, but I can imagine a situation where use Occupy or the Tea Party as examples of just, well, more or less grassroots power, not the establishment top-down power, but Americans, just regular Americans, call them from the 99.9% on down, who want to, you know, have their own say in how things work, they ought to be able to form these grassroots, independent, outside of power organizations and be able to finance them better and build them up better and use them higher for the right price, the people capable of using them well. You know, and I don't mean people who are already sold out to the establishment, but I just mean people who are, you know, got the brains and the talent and the skill to carry out something like really doing a stop gun controllers front or a stop warmongers front or a stop, you know, whatever, spending and find the worst offenders in Congress and oppose them. Or stop the damn Republicans at all costs, or stop the damn Democrats at all costs, or whatever your beef is. Regular people ought to be able to freely associate and spend as much money as they can to do this. The zillionaires already can and always have been able to all along since whatever bad old days you want to think of. It's always been that way. What's important is that, you know, regular people can put their money together to even begin to try to match it. And the laws that were just struck down were the laws that were preventing that. And so I'm not saying we have a completely open field now, because I don't know exactly what regulations remain and what, but it certainly should be a better situation for grassroots funding of political campaigns in opposition to, you know, incumbents out of favor and in support of issues and in support of new candidates and what have you like that. So if that's your business, I say get to it. It seems like the court just struck down a lot of illegitimate limits on your behavior. So, I hope to see some good come of this. And to see liberals saying, oh, well, now it's all going to be corrupt and in the hands of the rich and stuff like that. I mean, come on. If I was to do the facepalm thing as hard as I feel like, I'd knock myself right out. So I just got to let it slide. You know what? You're liberals and you're always going to think silly things. And sink important things. And that's just the way it is, I guess. You know, what am I going to do with you? What am I going to do with you? I don't know. All right. Anyway, campaign finance. I like this subject. I need to learn all the ins and outs and all the details and read all the reports and whatever. Because I think it's hilarious that people think that a bunch of sitting Republicans and Democrats are going to pass laws limiting their ability to prevent you from stopping them from doing what they want. Yeah, I really trust that John McCain when he passes something with Feingold. That's how you know it's good. It's bipartisan. The people who already have power keeping it that way act. All right. Didn't work out for Feingold. He tried. I guess he wasn't bad enough on everything. Anyway. All right, so Russia. I guess, in case you're not aware, maybe you're aware, I don't want to sell anybody short. If you're a regular listener to this show, you're aware, but in case you're just a regular consumer of American media and all of that, you should know that Russia's not on the march, and they're not building up a giant force ready to invade Ukraine. I suppose there's an outside possibility, a very unlikely one. I think the Americans would have to do 10 more stupid things, probably, to provoke it, but it was an American coup d'etat in Ukraine that provided the excuse, anyway, for Russia to retake the Crimea. They didn't kill anybody in doing it. I'm not really a nation state guy, but as far as nation states go, Crimea was only under the jurisdiction of Ukraine as a technicality anyway, really. It's belonged to Russia since the time of the Articles of Confederation here in America, the 1780s. Which they took it by force and all of that, but, what are you going to do? Come on, that's history. That's how it goes. And anyway, all this boogeyman stuff about the re-rise of Russia and the Soviet Empire and who's going to contain them and who's going to stop them and all of that, I hope you are aware, at least, that some people don't believe that. And not all a bunch of tie-dye hippies and commies and freaks, but plenty of people who know anything about it, of all political descriptions, think that that's completely stupid. And in fact, some of the leaders of the establishment, people like Leslie Gelb, the former president of the Council on Foreign Relations, and even Henry Kissinger, have written articles in major publications like the Washington Post and the Daily Beast saying, hey guys, as long as we're going to make policies about Russia, we ought to leave all of the hyperbole to the side and pay attention to the actual facts and construct our policy around the actual facts because, if we make our policy around self-delusion, we could cause problems for ourselves. Seriously. These are what some of the most powerful people in America are saying. That, hey, you're going off half-cocked here, people in immediate authority right now, and you need to chill out. And I would say, not very often, I would say you need to take Henry Kissinger's advice on this one. But certainly you do. This is one of those cases where he agrees with me, so my confirmation bias interprets that as meaning that, see, even Henry Kissinger says this is a bunch of nonsense. And I'll make one more point about this, in case you're not aware, because you might not really understand. It used to be that the Russian army, if you want to call it that, the Soviet army, occupied a dozen countries. All of Eastern Europe and Central Asia, and they just don't anymore. Their military is a tiny fraction of what it was, and it occupies a tiny fraction of the land it used to occupy. The USSR is 25 years gone. Gone. You know what? This news is completely retarded, so I'm going to go ahead and talk more. Here's the other thing, too. Palestine. Israel-Palestine peace talks on the brink of collapse. You know why? It's because the Israelis are not honest players in the game at all. They are liars and murderers and thieves writ large. And what they're doing is they're stealing the West Bank and East Jerusalem for themselves. And at some point, obviously, their plan is... And they'll have to probably be another big war of one kind or another. Don't worry, they'll be able to gin it up. And then they'll use that war as the cover to go ahead and force march all of the Palestinian Christians and Muslims out of the West Bank and probably just straight into the Jordan River and swim if you're lucky kind of a thing and drive them all into Jordan, drive all the Gazans into Egypt. Or maybe they'll just leave Gaza for a time. But anyway, soon, relatively soon, the status quo will no longer be able to hold in the occupied territories of the West Bank and East Jerusalem. And then the Israelis are going to what? Give up majority democratic rule to the Palestinians? No. They're going to do like Andrew Jackson did to the Cherokee. They're going to pull out their bayonets. They're going to do like they did to the Palestinians in 48 and all the way through. They're going to keep doing what they've been doing. It'll be the Nakba Part 2, and they will force march the people of Palestine out of the West Bank. Isn't it obvious that that's what their plan is? They're keeping the West Bank, and they're keeping East Jerusalem. And on their wildest exaggeration of the pretension that they would ever accept a Palestinian state, they still describe it as basically game over, they win anyway. That's their description of giving in, is, yeah, but we get to control your borders, and we get to control your police, and we get to control your taxation authority, and we get to occupy you and colonize you and steal your West Bank and keep it forever. That's what they're negotiating toward. And so it's a joke, and the joke is over. Nobody's buying it anymore. The Israelis just are not honest brokers anymore. And if anything, this was America giving them one last chance to try to pretend that they are. And so the whole world's laughing. You know, and it's bitter laughter, but it's laughter. And now the Palestinian Authority is going to the United Nations. And the loophole is you have to sign up for, what is it, 15 different UN member organizations. And then at that point, what, do they have to hold a new... vote or something about full statehood for Palestine. They're just going to go ahead and unilaterally declare a Palestinian state. Maybe that's what will start the war. And then Netanyahu will just go in there and kill them all, or go in there and force march them all into the Jordan River and steal all of the last of their property in, you know, Judea and Samaria. Because 2,000 years ago in Hebrew mythology, all this land belongs to them, not to the people who are obviously the actual descendants of the Hebrews of 2,000 years ago and still live there. But anyway, so that's it. And America, of course, is complicit in every way because it's our money. And it's America's cover for the Israelis in the UN Security Council that lets them all get away with it all. All right, and now here's Bob Dreyfus. Oh, and good luck to the Palestinians. I don't know what the hell's going to happen to them, but I don't know. Anyway, Bob Dreyfus, warlords and corruption are on the rise as Afghanistan prepares to vote. A very important story, and I don't know why Bob don't like me no more. He don't want to do radio at all anymore, I guess. He used to be a favorite of mine on the show. He's a brilliant guy. And anyway, so please read him here at The Nation. Warlords and corruption are on the rise as Afghanistan prepares to vote. It's a very well-done piece on what's going on in Afghanistan. And then there's new torture news that, I don't know, maybe I'll get a chance to cover it with Will Grigg. And there's Egypt news too, man, some terrorist attacks and stuff. But right now I got to go because I got to get Will Grigg on the phone. So hang on just one sec. Now hear this. Don't worry about things you can't control. Isn't that what they always say? But it's about impossible to avoid worrying about what's going on these days. The government has used the war on guns, the war on drugs, and the war on terrorism to tear our Bill of Rights to shreds. But you can fight back. The 10th Amendment Center has proven it, racking up major victories. For example, when the U.S. government claimed authority in the NDAA to have the military kidnap and detain Americans without trial, the nullifiers got a law passed in California, declaring the state's refusal to ever participate in any such thing. Their latest project is offnow.org, nullifying the National Security Agency. They've already gotten model legislation introduced in California, Arizona, Oklahoma, Missouri, and Kansas, meant to limit the power of the NSA to spy on Americans in those states. We'd be fools to wait around for the U.S. Congress or courts to roll back Big Brother. Our best chance is nullification and interposition on the state level. Go to offnow.org, print out that model legislation, and get to work nullifying the NSA. The hero Edward Snowden has risked everything to give us this chance. Let's take it. Offnow.org. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show here. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. And right now, lucky you and me, we got Will Grigg on the line. He's the author of Liberty in Eclipse, which you ought to buy. And also, he's a great writer and a keeper of the blog, freedominourtime.blogspot.com. Pro Libertate is what it's called. Pro Libertate. freedominourtime.blogspot.com. Welcome back to the show, Will. How are you doing?
Scott, I'm doing well. I really appreciate your kindness.
Well, you know what? You sure get great work done, and I'm happy to highlight it, and I think it's really important, and I think that you're changing America for the better, actually, with the work that you do. And it's very important, and we can see this with Radley Balco's work, too. It's very important that we, and this is unfair, okay? I'm not saying this is my way. I'm just saying this is the world that we live in. We have to have people attacking the police state, especially when we're talking about local police forces, from the right. Because if government can simply dismiss all concern as civil rights for minorities concern, or just the views of tie-dye hippie concerns or whatever, then they just think that they don't have to listen to that. But when they're being written about in the Washington Post by somebody who comes from Cato and is a pretty, you know, right-wing libertarian as far as libertarians go, like Radley Balco, or somebody like you, and I'm not calling you much of a right-winger, you're pretty libertarian on the issues, but personally, you're a very conservative guy and all that kind of thing. You're not a cultural Marxist, as the right-wingers say, or anything like that, and so you're constantly, and you're good on civil rights. I'm not saying you're not, but I'm just saying, you know, the way that you cover this, I think it's really important for getting through to people that, you know what, even if you're an upper middle class, comfortable white person, this needs to be a concern of yours, okay? And I'm not calling you white either, but still.
Yeah, well, you're touching on something that's very interesting, and that is the cultural divide, this artificial dichotomy that was imposed on our country about a generation and a half ago by Nixon, when for reasons of cynical political advantage, he decided to play to the so-called silent majority, in his war on crime rhetoric. He actually declared war on crime, drugs in particular, back in 1971, and this was a deliberate move by him and his political image makers to try to capitalize on this type of fracture point that exists in American society between the perceived youth-oriented radicals and then the conservative Democrats, the so-called ethnic Democrat conservatives who were attracted to Reagan and before that Nixon's constituency. The idea was that only people with a tie-dyed mind would be concerned about such things as civil liberties or people who are interested for reasons of fomenting social revolution in playing to the grievances of inner-city minorities and people of that kind. That's a narrative that was imposed on us largely by Nixon, and that's where the so-called war on drugs comes from. And the war on drugs, I contend, is pretty much the fountainhead of the militarization of American police culture since then. And now it's gotten to the point, as you say, Scott, that people who had been living in supposedly privileged echelons of society that enjoyed a happy immunity to this pathology of privileged violence on the part of the police, they're starting to understand that they are not exempt and that people they care about are being caught in this evil undertow, and they're being run through a criminal justice system that is oriented toward creating fodder for our expanding, metastasizing prison industrial complex, or they're being beaten or tased or otherwise abused by the police or supposedly the centurions, the paladins of all that's good and decent in our society. And so there is a cultural change, and it's very much for the better. And my problem is that there is still, even now, despite the fact that we're approaching sort of the waning years of Barack Obama's presidency, there's still people in the Republican-aligned, law-and-order, conservative constituency who believe that the problem is that the wrong people are running this apparatus of repression. They don't understand that the apparatus itself has to be dismantled. I believe that if they end up with a sufficiently attractive standard-bearer for the Republican presidential campaign in 2016, many of these people will suddenly forget all the good things they're saying right now about civil liberties and the evil of wraparound surveillance and the vexations of a militarized law enforcement culture. If suddenly they find the right person to put upon the white steed, they'll believe that we can somehow redeem this instrument and then turn it against the right people. And, of course, that's the reverse of what Obama-era so-called progressives have said. You know, they have no problem at all with the idea of inheriting George W. Bush's internal security system, as long as people who are pro-gay marriage and have the right position on abortion and other cultural matters are running that instrument, then they have no problem with its existence. So, unfortunately, we're still, as a culture, bound up in these cynical cultural wars that were started by Nixon. And I'm just hoping that the temper of the public mood has changed dramatically. Events recently, for instance, in the state of New Mexico, indicate that people have had a surfeit at long last of the immunity and the impunity enjoyed by police when they're killing and otherwise inflicting criminal violence on harmless people. And so I do think that we've reached a threshold in our country where we're going to be seeing some changes. I'm still holding out hope that these changes will largely be peaceful, and they'll entail the repudiation of the idea of aggression. But I don't know whether or not that preference is going to be respected by the people who right now wield the implements of state-consecrated violence.
Yeah, I mean, it is. It's a matter of priorities. And, you know, these politicians, they'll always, even on an issue like this, and maybe it's, you know, one of the more difficult ones, but still, if it's a big enough parade, they'll want to get out in front of it. And
yeah.
So it seems to me, and maybe this would be a complete, you know, joke and it wouldn't work, but if you had, you know, an otherwise mainstream candidate for mayor in, you know, any town in America, who, you know, had a good shot of winning anyway or whatever, if he wanted to make it an issue that, you know what, you elect me mayor, I'm going to fire the police chief because I'm sick of this crap just like you are. And in fact, that's why I want to be your mayor, because this guy's got to go, and make an issue out of it like that, that could be so powerful, even if that ended up in a losing campaign. Just if people would try that occasionally. The reason I'm running for Congress is because I want to stop the Pentagon from equipping our local police with M16s anymore. That's why I want to run for Congress. Abortion? Never heard of it. Don't care. I just want to disarm the machine guns out of the hands of our sheriff's department. That's all. And see people put this as their first issue for for why they ought to have power. Because I think, like you're saying, people are catching on. They're like, yeah, you know, why should a cop have an M16, man?
Exactly.
We're not the VC. We're the Americans. We're the guys that you killed all those VC in the name of protecting our freedom.
Exactly. You make a very important point when you're talking about the transcendent importance in this issue of having a municipal government that is in some sense responsive to the needs and desires of the people they supposedly represent, because every municipal police department is the enforcement arm of the municipal corporation that pays the salaries of its members. They're not locally accountable to the people, and one of the greatest and most pernicious lies in the history of American dialogue is the truism, support your local police and keep them independent. They're not your local police. They are independent of you, and therein lies the problem. And one of the things that's happening in American Fork, Utah, which is a city about which I wrote a recent story in my blog that got a great deal of national attention, thanks to Radley Balko of the Washington Post, who accepted a large section of my story and made it national. American Fork is a town of about 21,000 people.
Oh, wait, you know what? make a different point, because in a minute and a half, we're going to have to go out to break, and I want to hear all about this. So I'll tell you what, save the story, but tell us quickly here for a minute or so. Catch us up on what you mentioned there about Albuquerque, New Mexico, and the people standing up for those of us who aren't caught up on
that
story.
You had this huge, I wouldn't say that it's reaching Ukrainian proportions, but you had a sizable street protest over the what it has to be called, the murder of this homeless man recently by Albuquerque police and by their allies and local law enforcement. James Boyd was somebody who was diagnosed with schizophrenia, apparently. He was surrendering after he had been rousted from a plot of land where he was described as being an illegal camper. In the course of surrendering, he was gunned down, execution style, by what you'd have to refer to as a death squad. And that's just one of many shootings over the last year or several years in New Mexico that reflect a dangerous and deadly evolution of the mindset of the police, something that has been made a matter of doctrine in their training academies.
I think they said it was 37 in 2 years, something like that.
Yeah, it's astounding. It's become a fair approximation in southwestern United States terms of what you would call actually a killing field if you adjust that demographically for the size of the populations involved. And so finally you had this, I'd have to call it, a peaceful uprising that, of course, was turned into a violent confrontation by the introduction of anti-riot techniques by the militarized police in Albuquerque.
Yeah, even but brought out the MRAP, mine-resistant Afghanistan war vehicle.
Exactly.
The citizens of Albuquerque protesting their excess. How do you like that, America? All right, we'll be right back with the heroic Will Grigg. Freedominourtime.blogspot.com right after this. On March 7th at the National Press Club in Washington, D.C., the Council for the National Interest is co-hosting the first-ever national summit to reassess the U.S.-Israel special relationship. Confirmed speakers include Walt Scheuer, Giraldi, McGovern, Katowski, Porter, McConnell, Weiss, Raimondo, USS Liberty survivor Ernie Gallo, as well as co-sponsors Alison Ware of If Americans Knew and the great Grant Smith of the Institute for Research Middle East Policy. That's the national summit to reassess the U.S.-Israel special relationship. Friday, March the 7th, all day at the National Press Club in Washington, D.C., natsummit.org.
All right. Welcome back to the show here. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, Scott Horton Show. ScottHorton.org is where I keep all my stuff. I'm looking right now at freedominourtime.blogspot.com. That's Will Grigg's blog, Pro Libertate. And the last couple are both very interesting here. He cooperated with the cops and is paying the price, the ordeal of Mark Bierge. Boy. And then Tales of the Happy Valley Gestapo, and I think that was the one you started to tell us there before I interrupted you before the break, Will, right?
Is the Mark Bierge story that I was referring to. I spent some time in central Utah recently, and I've done two stories, fairly lengthy stories, about horrible incidents of abuse. I'm working on the third one right now that's the sort of thing that really should be the plot of a made-for-television movie. But the case of Mark Bierge is the one that went viral in large measure because Radley Balk of the Washington Post picked up on the story. Here's a guy who was involved in a no-injury traffic accident on the streets of American Fork, Utah, which is a little town of about 21,000 people. Very wealthy, one of the wealthier enclaves there in Utah. Really shouldn't have a police department, but it has a 33-member police force. These are people who, 1 year after their probationary term, are making in the neighborhood of $65,000 or $70,000 a year to patrol a town that has no violent crime. And since 2007, every member of the American Fork Police Department who's on patrol is assigned a VidCam, which is a camera embedded into the portable walkie-talkie units as part of their standard gear. And they have been very conspicuous and boasting about the fact that they were the first police agency, perhaps the entire world, where every one of their patrol officers are constantly wired and that all interactions with the public are recorded and made available in order to bring about accountability. They've used this on many occasions to vindicate officers who've been accused of misconduct. In the case of Mark Bierge, you had three officers involved in this encounter that resulted in him undergoing crippling injuries completely unnecessarily. Not a single one of them provided VidCam footage of any of the relevant episodes in this protracted ordeal that lasted about 35 or 40 minutes and resulted in this man once again enduring an injury that may eventually kill him. Mark Bierge had suffered severe back trauma in an automobile accident several years ago. He underwent a $50,000 procedure to install a spinal cord stimulator, which sends electronic impulses up and down his spine in order to fool the pain receptors so that he doesn't have to be completely doped out on narcotic pain medications. And he was running a courier business at the time of this incident. This was a couple of years ago in American Fork, Utah. He collided his box truck into a branch that was overhanging the street in American Fork, and so he called the police because he had to fill out an accident report for insurance. He knew that he had an outstanding traffic ticket, and he suspected that trouble might be in the offing, so he wasn't surprised when a police officer said he was going to have to arrest him because he had this outstanding traffic ticket. He called his wife, Mr. Burge did, and said, "Honey, I'm going to be at the jail. You'll need to come pick me up." And he left the line open. That's a very important part of the story. Mark turned to the police, then very carefully lifted up his shirt to display this iPod-sized device in the lower right back and said, "I've got this expensive piece of hardware that makes it possible for me to walk and have a normal life. Please don't cuff me behind my back because I can't reach back there, and I'm worried about disturbing this piece of machinery." And the cop ignored him and said, "Just stick your hands behind your back and shut up," or words to that effect. So Mark did what he was told, and he was put in the back of the car, and he was leaning forward to avoid contact between the handcuffs and this lower back section where this very expensive piece of hardware was embedded. And the officer saw that and shoved it back against the seat. And as this happened, Mark actually felt the device breaking. And he made a comment to the effect of, "You stupid son of a bitch, you've just wrecked my back." Now, on the way to the hospital, after the cop had relented and cuffed him in the front tardily, by this time the damage had been done, Mark pointed out, "Forgive me, I don't know if I said that they're on the way to the hospital, on the way to the jail," he said, "you're going to have to take me to the hospital because right now my my back is completely wrecked and I'm beginning to feel my legs start to malfunction." And it took him about 50 minutes to get there. By the time they got there, his right leg wasn't functioning because the injury was asserting itself and his receptors were misfiring and he started to undergo convulsions. When they got out of the car, either because the police officer thought that he was being uncooperative and resisting, which of course would be stupid. Why would you resist being taken to the hospital? Or for whatever reason, they ended up in a situation where Mark was face down in the dirt and this cop's knee was on the middle of his back, directly above this piece of machinery.
Right, where he already knows the guy has this implant.
Exactly. And so Mark gets dragged into the hospital covered with dirt and sweating and in agony. And he gasps out to the nurse, "I want you to call a third-party investigator from a different police department because this officer just assaulted me." And the officer responded by shoving Mark and telling him to shut up. And that provoked Mark, who'd been long-suffering and cooperative at this up to this point, into unleashing an expletive. And that offended the nurse. The nurse was indifferent until he'd said something that offended her pious Central Utah sensibilities. And it was on the basis of this episode that Mark was actually, that one little exchange, he was actually prosecuted for disorderly conduct. In the course of preparing for his trial, Mark went out and obtained sworn statements from several eyewitnesses and ear witnesses. Remember that the cell phone was still on. The line was open, and two people overheard everything that happened during this protracted encounter with Officer Andres John Felice of the American Fork Police Department. He got sworn statements from several people. He obtained all the relevant medical records showing that the moment that he was taken into police custody, just shortly thereafter in any case, that the device malfunctioned and is now irreparably damaged. He is able to get medical records showing that he now suffers from Cripps syndrome, which is a compartmentalized regional pain syndrome. That's something that's causing his foot to atrophy and his leg to atrophy. It's a very, very good chance that he's going to lose his foot or perhaps even suffer major organ failure. When I talked to him, he was perpetually clenched in visible pain in spite of the fact that he'd had to ramp up his prescription meds to just a shocking extent, 300 or 400 percent of what he had been using before he had the SCS damage. And his right leg is permanently contorted. His foot is constantly clenching and misfiring. He has no control over it. He ended up losing his job. He lost his business. He lost his home. And then he lost his case because the prosecutor who had conducted the investigation, the supposedly independent investigation of this incident, refused to put any of the officers under oath when they were making their statements. And the statements, of course, were contradictory. Police are trained to lie. They're given social permission to lie. You have to assume that everything they say is a lie unless it's validated independently. None of their statements were sworn because the prosecutor said that these are oath-bound peace officers, so everything they say is effectively under oath anyway. And none of the footage was made available, in spite of the fact that American Fork Police Department made a fetish out of having these vid cams. And so when he got to the trial, he was told that he couldn't use any of these earlier statements to impeach what had been said in subsequent investigations of the various police officers involved in this, because their subsequent statements were not sworn and hence were inadmissible. It's the same prosecutor who had said that he was going to swear them when he was conducting the supposedly independent inquiry. So he lost the case, and he's found guilty of disorderly conduct because he had unleashed a somewhat malodorous epithet in the direction of a man who just wrecked his back and ruined his life, who's a privileged member of the government's enforcement cast. That's in American Fork, Utah. This story had been completely ignored before I reported it a couple of weeks ago. The day after I published this blog essay, and I think this is the day before Mr. Balco picked up on it at the Washington Post, the CBS affiliate in Salt Lake City, KUTV, actually went out and interviewed Mark. And there have been a couple of other local radio and television journalists, and there have actually been some radio journalists here in the state of Idaho as well who've covered this story. Mark is actually running for the state legislature. What the heck? He can't make an honest living anymore, so might as well go into politics. But he's doing this as a voice of people who've suffered abuse at the hands of people who are supposedly public servants. But more importantly, there's a move underway right now to put pressure on the mayor of American Fork. And that underscores something I'd said before the break, Scott, which is that if you want to know where the problem is going to be solved, you have to start focusing on your local, which is to say your municipal government, the city council and the mayor. You're going to have to make it pretty clear that because you cannot hold police accountable, you can't hold police chiefs accountable, you're going to hold them accountable. And there's another story I've written about, actually several stories, in the city of Idaho Falls involving an extravagantly corrupt police chief. And then the former mayor of Idaho Falls was another former police chief. And right now in the city of Idaho Falls, I'm happy to say, there are people who are starting to put pressure not only on the police chief there, his name is Mark McBride, but also on the newly elected mayor, who's inherited a great big mess, including a $300,000 lawsuit by a family that got beaten up in their own home because of a noise complaint last Labor Day weekend. So that's one of the things that I find encouraging, is that at last people are starting to demand accountability of anybody who happens to be electorally accountable for the actions of the police that they hire. And then what's going on in Albuquerque and elsewhere in New Mexico is healthy, because that illustrates that people have at last gotten a surfeit of what has to be considered perhaps the, on a statewide basis, the most lawless law enforcement culture in the entire American Soyuz. The head of the Albuquerque Police Academy, a fellow by the name of Jack Jones, this is something that was reported by the Santa Fe New Mexican last February. He's created a curriculum now where he overtly instructs law enforcement officers in Albuquerque to see the public as their enemy. This is from the Santa Fe, New Mexico. Quoting Jack Jones, "Evil has come to the state of New Mexico. Evil has come to the Southwest. Evil has come to the United States." And then he goes on to explain how they must assume that in every encounter between the police and the public, that the police are at terrible risk. And then when people started to inquire, after all these shootings you described, Scott, people started to inquire about what they were training people at the New Mexico Police Academy.
That's what I was going to ask you, was this sounds like these guys are going through a different boot camp even than the rest of these marauders.
Yeah, and we're seeing the results. That's one of the reasons why you're seeing this tangible impact of these of this indoctrination to believe that the police are on a 360-degree battlefront. They have to engage the public as the enemy and subdue them. But what he has said...
Well, and it just goes to show what idiots they all are, that they can possibly be trained to think that the people of the neighborhood that they grew up in are all a bunch of terrorists or whatever crap.
Yeah. Well, in September, continuing with the story, the state's 8-member Law Enforcement Academy Board, which is appointed by the governor and chaired by the attorney general, voted unanimously to change the New Mexico Administrative Code to give complete control over the curriculum to Jones. He's the one who says that the public is evil. And he's refusing to release any of the training materials to the public for reasons of officer safety and force security. What he says essentially is, if there is something happening that is new technology that the bad guys are using, that evil is using, we need to be able to make that change and be able to make those changes in our academy, and then, of course, to maintain security over what they teach their troops. because if they were to reveal to the public that they supposedly serve, how these people are being trained, well, that might compromise the all-important officer safety consideration here that is the highest and holiest of all public policy matters. So you have this ideological or doctrinal change the way that police are trained in New Mexico, and the result is that you have dozens or scores of dubious or frankly unjustified shootings, including this horrible spectacle of a poor mentally ill man who's surrounded by police officers being gunned down for no defensible reason because he just happened to be squatting on an abandoned piece of supposedly public property. So I think that in New Mexico, I'm hoping that at least we, at long last, we've reached peak jackboot, which is to say the threshold at which the public is no longer willing to countenance the impunity and the self-indulgent lawlessness of people in government costumes, at least in the state of New Mexico.
Yeah.
But think about just how horrible it has gotten and how horrible it had to get in order for people to reach that threshold.
I know it. All right. I'm sorry. You know what? That's a perfect place to leave it, but we got to leave it. We're over time, and I got to go to the next guest. But thanks so much, Will. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Scott. Take care.
Everybody, that's Heroic Will Grigg. Go look at his website. It's so good. He's such a great writer. You can tell by the way he talks. He's that good of a writer, too. Pro Libertate at freedominourtime.blogspot.com. And we'll be right back with Todd Pierce right after this. Man, you need some new stickers for the back of your truck. Scott Horton here for LibertyStickers.com. Aren't you sick and tired of everyone else being wrong about everything all the time? Well, now you can tell them all what's right with some stickers from LibertyStickers.com. At LibertyStickers.com, they're against everything, so you know they're good on your issue, too. Whether it's the wars, police state, gun laws, the left and right, or the president, LibertyStickers.com has hundreds of choices so you can find just the right words to express your opposition and contempt for those who would violate your rights. That's LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. All right, sorry, you guys. I'm over time, running over my break and running over everything and trying to get it straight here. Well, the good news is I've got Todd E. Pierce on the phone. It is a former major, Todd E. Pierce. He is a defense lawyer, a JAG lawyer, down at Guantanamo Bay. And now he's a writer, and here he is at consortiumnews.com with this piece. And I like it. It's April Fool's Day, so it's okay. We're all Cheneyites now. Say it ain't so, Todd. Welcome back to the show. How are you doing?
I'm doing well, but I'm afraid I can't say it isn't so. I think it's the only way of looking at how things are today. We have adopted Dick Cheney's viewpoint of the world.
Yeah, afraid so. And I got to tell you, your audio is just absolutely horrible right now. Are you just on the, you're just using the regular handheld, just regular way, no speakerphone or headphones or anything? Todd, can you hear me? You know what, guys? I think the Todd Pierce interview isn't working out. Todd, are you there? Check, check. All right, well, I know he was in a difficult spot, apparently, very difficult. Dang. All right, one more try. Take three. Take four. Hey, Todd, are you there? Check, check. All right, okay, gotta move on. All right, well, Todd Pierce, everybody. He wrote this great thing. It's called We're All Cheneyites Now, and maybe I'll interview him about it tomorrow. Or some other day. It's all right. These things happen. It's live radio. No big deal. So anyway, the story, if you're not familiar, you might like to learn about it. It's all about Dick Cheney and all the terrible things that he believes and all the horrible people that he hired to write papers describing the future of American policy and why everything sucks. Or at least why everything that does suck sucks because of Dick Cheney and the terrible things he believes and the horrible people that he hired to write his papers for him. Todd Pierce, we're all Cheneyites now at Consortium News, and that is true. It's kind of a whether you like it or not sort of a thing. You are a Cheneyite by default because you just can't help it because there's nothing you can do about it because they decided for you. All right. Well, good. So this gives me a chance to talk about torture for a minute here. So let me see here. I got Jason Leopold tweets Feinstein on CIA report. Senate Intelligence Committee votes to declassify portions of CIA detention interrogation study. Washington Senate Intelligence Committee Chairman Dianne Feinstein released the following statement. Yeah, you already said that. After the committee voted to declassify the executive summary and conclusions of its landmark report on the CIA's detention and interrogation program, the Senate Intelligence Committee this afternoon voted to declassify the 480-page executive summary, as well as 20 findings and conclusions of the majority's 5-year study of the CIA detention and interrogation program, which involved more than 100 detainees. The purpose of this review was to uncover the facts behind the secret program and So they're going to release the summary and the conclusions soon. The full 62 now? I thought it was 63, guys. The full 6,200-page full report, the full 6,200-page full report has been updated and will be held for declassification at a later time. If you're lucky, I think they meant to say there. Maybe, but probably not really, I think, was how that sentence was supposed to end. So there you go. They're at least they're going to release the executive summary. And we'll learn some new things. And then, you know, I don't know, maybe nobody cares anymore because it's too late now. Is it too late now? You know, you look at all the countries where war criminals ended up being held to account. Well, not all the countries, like there's a whole lot of them, but there are some. And sometimes it seems like it takes a little while. This is a point the other Scott Horton needs to make on the show that, you know what? It might not be till 2025. That George W. Bush finally ends up in the dock. But the truth is that he's a criminal. And so there's a chance, at least, that he will be held accountable eventually. It's as simple as that. He's guilty. Everybody knows that. First of all, Your Honor, just look at him. I mean, everybody knows that he's the guy that signed the memos. He doesn't deny it. He and Dick Cheney both say, yeah, what? That's their legal defense. We can do whatever we want. But the truth is that the law says otherwise. The law says if you torture people and if you murder people, then you go to prison. And the law actually even says, if you try to claim that it was necessary, that cannot be, will not, may not, shall not be considered as a defense. Your defense that you say you had to, the law already explicitly denies your claim to even introduce that argument in court. Screw you and your necessity defense is built right into the law. So, you can't torture people. That's what the law says. Now, you can torture people. If you're a Republican or a Democrat and you want to torture somebody, then you do what you want. But I'm just saying, that ain't what the law says. And I guess it's possible that if enough information came out and if Americans cared and wanted something done about it, and demanded something was done about it, and you could have accountability. I think it's possible. That's why I bother to waste my breath for even a moment on campaign finance, is that I'm an anarchist. I'm against all this. I'm an abolitionist. But at the same time, not even but, and at the same time, I think that we need coalitions of people to agree on the most important things, and to be good on the most important things, so that we can put a stop to the very worst things right now. And so, if opening up who may be permitted to contribute however much they want to, to a political campaign, not just billionaires, but regular people too, then I think that that's probably progress. Not that that means I'm endorsing the entire system. But anyway, so here Dianne Feinstein, she's going to release, they voted today, the Senate Intelligence Committee voted today, not to release the whole report, but just the summary. But I bet you there's some good stuff in there. And I bet you once Marcy Wheeler's done reading it and telling us what she saw, there'll be plenty for people to be outraged about. Hey, what do you know? They lied all along about the torture program, which means that all Americans who defended the torture program by repeating things that they thought they knew about it that justified it, they were all wrong. They were, what would Lenin call them? Useful idiots of the Republican Party and the torturers in power. Oh no, they're only torturing terrorists. Oh no, they had to get very important information. Oh yeah, torture is how they found Osama bin Laden. Oh yeah, torture saved the day from the orange alert turning red. If it wasn't for torture, you and your family would all have burnt to ashes by now in a nuclear terrorist attack. Good old torture. Haven't you ever seen Fox TV? It works great. That's what it's for, working and being great. And don't call it torture, because it's just enhanced interrogations. But yeah, you got to torture the truth out of them. But don't call it that. All of that, all those talking points, all based on lies, all of it lies. And when somebody, when the Congress said, oh yeah, this was useful at all for actually bringing in intelligence that protected Americans, prove it. They cited information that FBI agents got without torture and said, yeah, we tortured this out of the guy. But they're just lying. The only thing that torture was useful for was creating the impression that Saddam Hussein was buddies with Osama bin Laden. That was why they were torturing people right before and right after the war, in order to try to drown out the truth coming out with a bunch of nonsense about how necessary this all was. And anyway, so John McCain, check this out. Now, John McCain is horrible on everything. Everything. Liberals hate him. Conservatives hate him. Libertarians hate him. Everybody hates him. He's the worst. He even married an heiress of a beer cartel, which is the definition, the textbook definition of American participatory fascism and crony bailout economics. This friend of Keating, may he burn in wherever he believed people burn after they die. John McCain, who told the Vietnamese communists the routes that his buddies would be taking on their next bombing missions so that they could better position their anti-aircraft. This scumbag. Well, one thing about him is that they tortured him into admitting it, or at least they threatened to. I don't know if anybody so much has ever really thumped his ear or what. But anyway, supposedly he was tortured himself. And so that's why he's against torture. And he said there's some chilling stuff. He can't tell you what it is, but he's seen the secret report and knows about what's in it. And he's heard a lot about it. And there are stories that are so chilling that he can't even repeat them right now. And then he talked about how the CIA said, we've gotten everything we can out of this guy. And the White House said, and headquarters, CIA headquarters said, torture him some more. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future Freedom Foundation at fff.org/subscribe. Since 1989, FFF has been pushing an uncompromising moral and economic case for peace, individual liberty, and free markets. Sign up now for The Future Freedom, featuring founder and president Jacob Hornberger, as well as Sheldon Richmond, James Bovard, Anthony Gregory, Wendy McElroy, and many more. It's just $25 a year for the print edition, $15 per year to read it online. That's fff.org/subscribe. And tell them Scott sent you. All right, you guys. Welcome back to the show here. I'm Scott Horton. Now, I don't know if this is really true or not. You see this where they say Kim Jong-un is going to execute 200 high-ranking officials? Hey, maybe that's a good thing. Nah, it's really just a power play between the Communist Party and the military there. And so, I don't know, I guess the military's coming out ahead of the Communist Party, is that it? I don't know, maybe he's killing off all the worst of the communists and they're going to change their ways and become more better. It seems like North Korea could hardly be a worse place to live for the people who are stuck there, you know? I don't know. If I was the dictator of North Korea, I would round up and execute 200 Communist Party leaders and whoever else were, you know, helpers there. You know, if I was the new guy, inherited the place from my dad. Huh, I'm a dictator of a communist dictatorship, huh? I think I'll round up and kill all the communists and then abolish the entire state and resign. And then we'll all be free. Everyone celebrate, you know, if you want to. That's what I would do if I was the communist dictator of North Korea. So that's why I entertain the possibility that, you know, assuming the story's true at all, he is to execute 200 people, says somebody. Okay, well, let me know when he actually does. That's the only reason I think that, well, you know, if this is true, maybe it's a good thing. It seems like if they're high-ranking officials in North Korea, they deserve to die, by definition, right? If anybody deserves to die, it's probably them. I'm not saying that I would give license to the American Empire to do the killing or go to war or anything horrible like that. I'm just saying, you know, if Kim Jong-un is going to have anybody shot, they should be people at the highest levels of the North Korean government. And then, you know, maybe himself too. Whatever. Anyway, I don't know what's going to happen there. Hopefully it'll lead to peace and stability instead of worse problems. Maybe it'll lead to worse problems. Really can't say. And you know what? I don't know hardly anybody who knows really about who's who and who's on whose side in North Korea. I bet Doug Bandow could say something about it. John Pfeffer, maybe. But, yeah, John Pfeffer, but in what level of detail? I don't know. I guess it all remains to be seen anyway, so it's sort of a moot point. Buried bombs outside Cairo University killed top police official. I know what you're saying. Meh. I know, right? But so here's my thing, though, is I wonder what this portends. I wonder what's going to happen. Of course, Mohamed Morsi was overthrown last summer by Field Marshal al-Sisi. He's a real tough guy. And, oh, it's Sisi. I shouldn't make fun of him. He's a real big, tough dictator type. But anyway, so now he's just resigned because I guess he's got his plan to rig the upcoming election for himself in place and ready to implement. So he's now resigned his position as high field marshal and is now running for quote-unquote president of the military dictatorship of Egypt. And so what's happened is they've rounded up and arrested hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of leaders of the Muslim Brotherhood, the guys that won the parliamentary and then the presidential election before they canceled it. But then there are other groups. Now, the Muslim Brotherhood has actually given out, you know, an edict or whatever that don't fight back, or at least not too hard. Don't commit acts of terrorism anyway. Defend yourself, maybe. I don't know exactly what they said, but something about restrain yourselves. Do not go holy jihad on this issue, because that'll make us look bad. Their tactic is to wait and to play the victims that they clearly are in real life. So assuming that they can get their younger and angrier members to follow their directions, seems like this probably isn't them. It's more likely these acts are being carried out. Well, first of all, I guess it's possible by the government themselves in order to cry boo-hoo, you know, while eliminating internal enemies or whatever. That's a possibility. But more likely, these are more radical outlier groups who are now gaining in power and influence since the cancellation of the elections. You know, this has been a big deal of Ayman al-Zawahiri's all along. This is a big part of the creation of al-Qaeda in the first place, as a mob marriage between the Azzam group that bin Laden took over, and I guess, was it bin Laden or Zawahiri that had Azzam killed in the first place? I'm not sure all that history that well, but anyway, the Azzam group, bin Laden's group of the Saudis, mostly, they combined with Egyptian Islamic Jihad, and this was always Zawahiri's thing, that for the Muslim Brotherhood to participate in the system of Egypt as it existed under the American-backed Mubarak dictatorship in any fashion whatsoever was compromising with the devil and Yahya and so holy war, right? Same as the blind Sheikh Omar Abdel Rahman, the guy that him and his buddies, you know, were the ones who did the First World Trade Center attack and plotted to bomb the Lincoln and Holland tunnels and the UN building and all that back in the early 90s. And anyway, so that was their whole point, is that if you think that democracy has to go hand in hand with modernity, then you're a damned fool. The Americans will never let you win and participate really in the democracy and be the elected government of Egypt, no matter by what percentage you ever win. So, you know, this was his denunciation of the Muslim Brotherhood. They ought to all be radicalized and become al-Qaeda like him and go to war against the Americans who are propping up the local dictatorship there. That was his point of view since the 90s. That was how they sold their al-Qaeda war against America. Is attack the far enemy first, drive them in, trick them like a big stupid bull into invading and bogging themselves down in as many places as possible for as long as possible to bleed themselves to bankruptcy so that their empire has to finally leave the Middle East entirely, and then they could get back to their local jihads and attempted takeovers of the government and all of that. That was the strategy all along. And so now what's Zawahiri and al-Qaeda saying? See, told ya. You win the you overthrow the dictator, you win the elections to parliament, you win the elections to the presidency, and what happens? The Americans and the military cancel the elections, put themselves back in power again. And so it sounds to me like the kind of thing where young Egyptians are going to find that a compelling talking point. Just like before, they've always found their talking points about the occupation of Arabia and the support for dictatorships and the bombings and invasions across the Middle East and, of course, support for the Israeli occupations in Palestine, etc. To be compelling talking points. And now, as Patrick Coburn has shown, and you guys saw this, right? Did I do a good enough job of highlighting this for you guys that at The Independent and at UNS.com, they have this five-part series by Patrick Coburn. And let me tell you something in case you don't know. Just trust me that Patrick Coburn is an authoritative source on this, okay? And what he writes is about the new rise of al-Qaeda, the next generation of al-Qaeda, the guys who were young during the last war in Iraq. They're now the commanders of the next generation. And, man, it's on. And they're in America. An American foreign policy has spread these guys. And by the way, this is what I've been trying to tell you for a decade straight. But anyway, America has taken a tiny little band of pirates of a couple of hundred guys on the Durand Line in exile on the ass end of the planet Earth, on the border between Afghanistan and Pakistan, and turned them into a massive movement from a group, from an organization, from even a so-called franchise or anything, to a movement of the most extremist, radical, Salafi, Sunni jihadists, most purist, most violent, most uncompromising, And that's actually to our advantage in a way that our enemies are such ridiculous cartoon characters of a holy warrior that they are very self-defeating in everything they try to do, thank God. But anyway, there are now thousands of them. American foreign policy has created thousands of them. Just like Colleen Rowley tried to tell you before the invasion of Iraq. She said, if you invade Iraq, you're going to create this gigantic territory for these guys to come and train and fight. They even used that as the excuse for the war for a time. Remember that? Andrew Sullivan and the flypaper thesis? Oh, yeah. There's a finite number of terrorists, and we're drawing them all to Iraq to kill them, and then we'll be done killing them. You stupid idiot. Could he have possibly been honest making that case? I mean, Donald Rumsfeld wanted him to make it. I get that. But anyway, so now there are tens of thousands of these guys, and we spread them as far west as Mali. And they're building a drone base now to, you know, to multiply their numbers in Western Africa. Of course, fought a war for the Mujahideen, the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group, and Ansar al-Sharia, and what was the other one? I'm leaving out the name of one of these Libyan groups from 2011 that was... fought as shock troops in the war against Gaddafi. And then, of course, al-Nusra and the reborn ISIS. The war in Iraq, of course, as Patrick Coburn's been saying on this show for 3 years now, that the American, Saudi, Qatari, Turkey, Turkish, Israeli war in Syria, support for the Mujahideen there has helped to re-energize and restart the war in Iraq. And battle rages on. There are now thousands of these guys, guaranteeing more catastrophes and more intervention for decades to come if we don't just knock this off. It's the only way to win the war is just to quit.